another week of Smart Mouth. I'm your host, Catherine Spires. And before we get into the show, I wanted to give a couple thank yous to new patrons on Patreon. Craig, who did not provide a last name, very mysterious. Thank you so much for donating to the cause. And then also, a big thank you to Kenter Farms, which is the company owned by a previous guest of ours. I guess Andrea Crawford really liked being on the show because now she is a donor. We aren't supposed to say donor according to Patreon's rules and regulations. She's a contributor, a friend of the show. So thank you, everybody. And if other people would like to contribute, it's at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. All right. Now we're getting into the show. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, lovely. Thank you.
So Jeremy Fall is a restaurateur and he has a couple different places in a couple different cities.
Yes. Mainly based in Los Angeles, but also have a restaurant in Chicago as well that I opened this past November.
Why on earth would you get into the restaurant business?
I ask myself that every day. Uh-huh. So I can't actually give you a proper response to that because I still don't know it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think that, you know, if you can survive happily, you can consider yourself successful in this business. And it's what I love to do. And it's, you know, that's what I've done pretty much my whole life. So that's why I'm still kicking.
Are you ever in the kitchen cooking food?
I have been in the past, but not really. I mean, in terms of like recipes, we develop the recipes as a team. Like I'll come up with ideas. A lot of times some of these ideas are unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like every creative on this planet for everything, but
someone has to rein you in.
Right. Exactly. But we have a team of very talented, chefs and stuff that I get to work with. So it's really nice to be able to, come up with an idea and actually have someone help you execute it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. But I grew up with a stepfather who was a chef. Ex-stepfather was a chef, that's how I learned how to cook at an early age.
I see.
And I was, in the kitchen, and it's kind of in my blood to have seen that. And my mother owned a restaurant together, and I lived on top of it. So in downtown Los Angeles. Yeah. So I was literally, it really is in my blood. I've done everything you possibly can in a restaurant.
Oops.
So, yeah.
That is really cool. So what restaurant was it downtown?
It was Angelique Cafe in downtown Los Angeles.
Okay.
It was in 8th and Spring. It's Prue and Proper now, I think. Is that still there?
Yeah, okay. I think so. Or maybe if it's not, it doesn't matter.
It's where that was after, yeah.
Oh, how funny. Not many people can say that they lived above a restaurant growing up.
Oh, yeah, like legitimately above it.
Like much less one that their parents actually worked at.
Right. The kitchen for our home was actually the kitchen. We used the kitchen in the restaurant. We didn't have a kitchen in our home. So
what?
Yeah. So we had to use that one.
Was it actually zoned as an apartment or are you just kind of hanging out there?
Well, I think this was long enough ago that doesn't really matter anymore. But it was like a loft situation.
Oh my gosh, with no kitchen. So you had to go down there three times a day?
Pretty much, yeah.
And as a little kid, like if you wanted snacks, were you like going and getting in the way?
I had to go through the restaurant down because there's two floors. Because the restaurant was a two floor, so the top floor, I lived on the top floor, but there was also a door connecting directly into the restaurant, my front door. You had to go into the restaurant and get into my house.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I wanted a snack, which, I often didn't have to need to snack, hopefully, but I would have to go downstairs and downtown in, from 2000, I lived there from 2000 to 2006 or 7, 2007. It wasn't what it is today.
No.
8th and Spring was not.
It was a much less friendly place.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. I mean, we all had, we had metal curtains on our doors and
oh
everything.
My gosh.
Yeah, it's not like what it is today. I always try to tell people that who aren't from here and they're like, right. Oh, downtown's so glamorous. I'm like, yeah, it's beautiful. And it was its own way back then with its history, but it wasn't what it is today by any means.
No. It really went through a downturn there. A little bit.
Yeah.
Because it started a little glamorous like 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
I wasn't around back then.
Not quite then.
No.
Did having your front door open right into a restaurant give you like a weird sense of like boundaries and privacy?
Well, it wasn't like customers. It was open for breakfast and lunch.
Yeah.
And I was at school.
Right? Okay.
On weekends, it was it didn't feel invasive because that's like what I knew.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not like I would go out undressed into the restaurant. So it's fine. But yeah, I mean, I guess like that's what I knew. And it seemed normal at the time, but it's a cool story now.
It definitely is. You sent me your list of favorite foods and one of them really stuck out to me because I was like, well, that's something you don't see every day. And that's lobster thermidor.
Yeah.
Which I bet a lot of people like don't really even know what it is.
In like, I think in layman terms, it's a cheesy lobster made of brandy.
Yeah.
Like, that's like very simply put. It's probably not doing much justice to the dish, but.
Well, I think people get the idea. You just said
right.
cheese, it's a Gruyere, yeah. booze, right. and lobster. So it's people are probably alley, like, yeah, okay.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's it's a French dish, right? So I'm French. Like I said, you know, I grew up with my French mother and stepfather, who was a chef, a French chef, and the restaurant we had, well, they had, was French.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I got to discover early on a lot of these really cool dishes that you actually don't find. Not that lobster thrown is like impossible to find, but you don't in LA really. No, yeah. Most people don't know what it is and yeah. just don't even, you know, they know lobster like boiled.
Right, right. right.
Or grilled.
Right. We don't really like dress up the lobster so much.
No. I mean, you get like lobster rolls, but that's like the most it really.
Yeah, either butter right. or mayonnaise. Because the lobster thermidor also often has egg yolks mixed
yeah.
into it.
Yeah.
And apparently dry mustard is an mm-hmm. important part of the flavor. And then you take it out of the shell and you serve it back in the shell.
Right, exactly.
After you put it under the broiler with the cheese on top. And not just any cheese, yeah, like you said.
It has to be Gruyere.
Yeah,
of course. Yeah. I can't even think about doing another cheese.
You know, you're the second recording we've done in a row where the guest has been like, Gruyere, nothing but Gruyere.
Really?
So I'm like, okay, guys.
it's the French in me that, yeah.
But. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you were born here, though. You didn't. You
born
were
born and raised. In,
okay.
Yeah,
so. Do you go back to France often?
Not as much as I'd like to.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't have like an abundance of time to be able to travel right. Europe. But, my grandparents come visit here. I try when I can. I'm hoping to get there within the next year, but not that
Who
often.
Knows? Do you speak French?
Yeah, that's all I speak with my family.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, cute.
Yeah, that's I've gotten that reaction before.
I know. It like came naturally out of me, and I'm not even sure why.
It's the one language for some reason in America that people get very infatuated by.
We think it's so fancy.
Right. And then when you're French, it's you're like so, it's just everyone in France wants to speak English like American mm-hmm. person. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Grass is always greener language-wise, right. I guess. So lobster thermidor was invented in the Gilded Age, which is what we call like the 1890s-ish.
Yeah.
And Gilded Age means like what it means specific to naming that time period. That is that like everything looks good on the outside, but it's actually rotten. Because it was the era of like the robber barons. So people who had a lot of wealth were really ostentatious with it. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of strife and poverty in the country at the same time, which... It's kind of interesting because lobster thermidor being invented in the Gilded Age, it was actually named for something specific to do with the French Revolution. So it kind of like ties back in to an earlier period okay. of strife and class warfare and whatnot. So generally speaking, upscale restaurants in the 1890s were getting super into lobster.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big deal to them because there were also dishes like lobster Newburg. Lobster a la Delmonico, lobster Victoria. These all kind of have the same ideas where you take the meat out, you mix them with various things. Like lobster Victoria was mushrooms, onions, parsley, and then you...
I've had that, yeah.
Have you had it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you have it?
I didn't know this was called, but I have had it. Yeah.
Did you have it in croquette style, though?
No, it's like...
In the lobster shell,
yeah.
Okay, because I guess another way to do it was basically like to croquette it.
Right.
And so... People were just like really getting into the lobster, and I think a lot of it had to do with it was becoming a fancy
right.
ingredient, whereas it hadn't yeah. always been. And in fact, there were the restaurants that were like the flashy places in big cities. Those were called lobster palaces.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And... It was generally.
What does a lobster palace look like?
Well, they were extremely ostentatious, and we would call them decadent in retrospect.
Right.
There was a magazine article in 1909 where the writer is talking about lobster palaces, and they describe them as nobody of distinction of appetite goes to a lobster palace to eat. One goes there in gaudy mood or when every other place is filled or closed or with the kind of man who thinks gaiety means overdressed women, bediamonded men, waiters rushing with champagne as if they had the fire buckets, and a caterwauling orchestra.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like anything we have here.
Doesn't it?
No, not
it
really.
It sounds like Michelli's yeah, in a little
it,
bit.
It kind of does. Yeah, it doesn't sound like the very California vibe that we have here.
Right, because this was mostly like New York, London, Paris.
Right, that makes
for
sense.
For sure. But I just think it's so funny just that it sounds horrific, but also like very much the place to be.
Oh, I would absolutely go. I didn't say I wouldn't go. I'm just, yeah, it's interesting.
Would you be diamond?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, of course. That's how you eat lobster.
You got to wear diamonds.
Covered in diamonds.
Yeah.
Head to toe.
Absolutely. See, you get it.
Right, I do.
You get it.
I just walk around with diamonds.
How many diamond necklaces is the right number of diamond necklaces?
It depends on how tall you are.
Well, you're pretty tall.
Yeah, I'm 6'7", so it takes a lot of diamonds to cover a 6'7".
That works out nicely for you.
Yeah, that's, yeah. But thankfully, yeah.
And you got to get big ones, too. So within this milieu of fancy people being ridiculous and being bediamond and eating lobster all the time, lobster thermidor is the rare dish where we know exactly when and where it was invented. Presumably, unless all of history is wrong. But as far as we know, it is. It was January 24th, 1894 at a restaurant in Paris called Chez Marie.
Okay.
Which was kind of one of these lobster palace type places. And it was invented because there was a play opening that night at the Comédie Française. And the chef decided to, he had been working on this new dish and he decided to name it Thermidor after the play. And it doesn't seem like anyone involved in the play had anything to do with it. He was just like, oh, this is, I don't know, a tie-in or or maybe it was just his inspiration and didn't have any deeper meaning. So the play that was called Thermidor was about the French Revolution. But even 100 years after the revolution, it was still a really sensitive thing to talk about and address. So the play was shut down after three nights because there was the first night. And after the first night, people found out what it was about. And they came and they rioted at the theater on the second or third nights. So not only was it shut down, but it was banned in France.
That same night?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're like, you can't ever do this again. The ban only lasted a few years.
Okay.
But that's how sensitive people still were about the French Revolution.
It makes sense.
Is your family, like, have they lived in France forever?
Oh, well, not anymore, but...
Mm-hmm. Like your ancestors and whatnot?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Were they around during the revolution?
Absolutely.
Are there any stories or lore?
Not that I know of. That you mean that have been passed down?
Yeah, from that time. I know that's going back really far.
Yeah, I don't... Not really.
Okay. But,
my father's side is from Tunisia, so my mother, and he grew up in France, but my mother, my mother's half Caribbean, and her mother's French, and then she grew up in Paris. So, I mean, there's like a very...
Your mom is Caribbean?
Half Caribbean, yeah.
But grew up in Paris?
Yeah, with a French mother, and my dad's from Tunisia.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So they kind of...
I'm quite the melting pot.
Yeah, you really are. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you feel any connection to the Caribbean at all?
Yeah, I mean, not as much as, like France, right? Because I grew up in a French environment. But, I mean, if there's a massive, cousins of my mother and stuff that are full on, from Martinique. Right, so.
Well, do you ever get to visit there?
No, unfortunately, I still haven't gone, but
okay, I would put that on the list above France, honestly.
Because I've been to France too, so I would too. Yeah, no, I absolutely would, but I need to take a year off.
Are you going to be able to do that?
No,
I wouldn't think so.
No,
you're pretty young.
27.
You're 27.
Yeah.
What on earth are you doing running businesses?
I don't know. It's still to this day. I ask myself that.
Maybe that means that you get to retire like in your early 50s.
That's what I've always said.
Yeah.
But. When I started working at the industry when I was around 13, right? I did like the whole server buster thing. And then I started working in nightclubs at 16.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And then I opened my first place. I was 23. So I've always been ahead. But every time I would hit those goals, for some reason I thought I'd be like, when I was like a kid, I was like, I could just open a bar so then I could retire. And then I opened a bar and I was like, what the fuck are you thinking? It didn't. So now that I think I can retire at 50, when I'm going to be 50, I'm never going to want to stop, right?
I don't know. You might be exhausted. Yeah, I'm only 8 years older than you and already I'm like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people probably say that. I mean, I think that when it's like what you love to do.
And you still love doing it?
If I have a night off, I get excited because I get to go to a restaurant, which is in theory very much so what I do for a living.
Right.
So it's not really a night off per se, but that's all I really want to do when I'm off. So.
Interesting.
I don't see that slowing down anytime soon.
What were you doing working in clubs? And I don't mean it the way that I just enunciated. No, literally. What was the work that you were doing in clubs?
Oh, I had an idea for this all-age event that was on Monday nights for kids that were like basically 12 to 17, which I know sounds weird. But when you're that age, you, for some reason, it's not like, think of it like a school dance, but at a nightclub, no booze or anything. We did like Red Bull cocktails. We were sponsored by Red Bull and there was a DJ, but it was like, you know, you'd pay a cover charge and you felt like you're at a nightclub during the summer in LA on a Monday when there's nothing to do.
Oh.
So I pitched the idea to the Avalon. The first one failed miserably.
Okay.
But then we did it again and then it got better and then it eventually did really well. Then they hired me. I interned for them and then they hired me in house and I was working there for a few years.
Why did they allow you to do a second one?
I must have been very convincing. I think that they believed in the idea. It's just I didn't know what I was doing.
Oh.
So when you have to fill in, you know, we in retrospect, we had 250 people show up at the first one, right? Which doesn't sound like a failure.
Uh-huh.
But it's a 1,500 person venue.
Weeks.
Yeah. It looks
It looked a little sparse in there.
Yes. It's very sparse. Spread out over 4 hours, right? So, or whatever. Yeah, 4 hours. So,
so in retrospect,
it wasn't a failure in terms of what I learned from it, but financially for a nightclub that size, it was not great.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, I was, you know, it was discouraging. Mm-hmm. And I was, and then I, for years, I worked there when I left the Avalon. I was like, I'm never working in hospitality again.
Mm-hmm. Did you go do something else for a brief period of time?
For like a day.
What was it that you did?
I thought about some stuff. I had like side projects, but I always worked in hospitality. So it wasn't really, I never left hospitality. I'm just going to leave it at that.
You're like an addict, addict for work.
I mean, yeah, that's what it is. That's really what it is. But I think you need that in this industry because it's so consuming.
Right.
You know, when you're working from pretty much 9 or whatever a.m., and your brain doesn't shut off till 2, 3 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And it's 7 days a week and you're on call and everything, and, you know, you have to love it because if you see it as work hours, you just, you can't, you're working at, you know, 100+ hour weeks, you know.
Do you feel like you have a personal life or is it like you work with enough of your friends that you don't need to have a personal life outside of work too? Or how does that all work?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't have like the, I don't have like a crazy personal life where Saturday and Sunday I'm completely off, but I do find a way to have a personal life, right? Like, I mean, I do find a way to see friends and my mother and stuff like that. You know, if I didn't see my mother, she would kill me. So, so I guess so that's good, right? But yeah, I mean, you have to integrate it somehow. It's not like this time to this time I'm seeing friends. It's like it's somehow integrated into the general life, you know, when I'm not traveling, right? That's been the biggest hurdle recently. It was just, I travel a lot more now, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, you have so much energy. You have so much industry. So actually, much that too.
Energy.
Yeah, very industrious young man. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, back to Thermidor. So did you know that during the French Revolution, they invented a whole new calendar?
No, I wasn't aware of that, no.
It is so... neither was I. That is so big. That's bigger than just overthrowing the government. That's trying to recreate time.
I was aware of
time.
That.
My God. So let me pull it up.
They didn't teach me this when I was in school. So.
They didn't teach me it either.
I went to a French school, so I feel like...
Oh, they should have.
They should have.
Yeah, they definitely should have. So
they taught me a lot of shit that I didn't care about. They could have taught me this.
So they redid it into... It was still 12 months, but they did away with weeks, and each month included 3 10-day periods that they called... decades.
Right. We still use that.
Yeah. And what they were trying to do is like take royalty and Christianity out of the calendar. Oh. So the 10 days were called Primidi Duodi Tridi. Like it was just like 1 through 10. And then the months, the year started not in January. I think the autumn equinox is when it started. Yes, around September 22nd. But that was hard because equinoxes don't happen at the same time every year. And I don't know if they overlooked that or thought that they could overcome it or something like that. So the months were named after the weather, essentially, that was kind of going around Paris in any given month.
Just cold.
Yes. Yeah, so like there's niveaus
for
like the December, January part. There's Fructidor, which is for August.
Okay.
When you pick all the fruit.
Right.
Like, honestly. And then the one before Fructidor is Thermidor, which is sort of July to August, and that just means the hot time.
Okay. Oh, that's how, okay. That
yeah.
makes sense. Yeah. So they served a hot dish in the summer?
No. So the play was about Thermidor, but yeah, it premiered in January. Yes. Oh, yeah.
So they were serving a hot dish in the middle of summer.
Mm-mm. Well, I mean, once it was invented.
Right, once it was invented.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Totally. And also year started over. So 1792 was year one.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And this lasted for 12 years.
Okay. Then we went back to the...
One of the Napoleons in 1806 was like, enough.
Yeah, no.
Already. But it was only... people only had to legally abide by it for like a few years. And then the government kind of turned a blind eye because they knew that it was falling apart.
Yeah.
But... So it was completely done in 1806, but some cities were still officially using it as late as 1801.
Okay.
Which seems like it would be such a mind fuck. Each hour was 100 minutes, which meant that their hour, the Republican hour, was 144 of what we would consider minutes.
It sounds like a nightmare.
Right?
Right, yeah.
I can't even do regular math.
Right, no, it's just no.
I can't even imagine doing that. So the play was about something that actually happened in July of 1794 that ended the Reign of Terror, but only did it by executing a shit ton of people, including Robespierre.
Yeah.
So, and then that led to what was called the Thermidorian Reaction, which now is a term for when a revolution gets too wild. So people kind of like take it over from the real revolutionaries and they're kind of...
They dumb it down a little bit?
Well, yeah, and they kind of calm it down and maybe bring it back a little bit to maybe not even being that different from what the original revolution was against. For instance, the first French revolutionaries had been like, Catholics, we're not having any of this.
Right.
And when the Thermidorian Reaction happened, they were like, it's fine. They can, like, there's still some rules, but it's okay if priests, like, give masses now.
Maybe I did learn this in school.
Well, it seems like you're having a little bit of memory of this part, not the...
Yeah, I wasn't, like, the best in school. I mean, I did graduate, like, pretty nicely, but I wasn't very interested in school my whole life.
I mean, you were working in a nightclub when you were 16,
which, I don't know if that was the smarter decision than going to school, so I don't recommend anyone else does that, but, I hated school from the day I... set foot.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, and then I dropped out.
So you
some college.
Physically
some
went
college
to
is the
college.
Box is the box that I check on those like DMV applications or whatever.
Some
it is.
College.
I'm glad that they have that there because I did 3 years and I'm like, I need to get some sort of credit for it.
Why would you do 3 years and then drop out before the last year?
Well, the thing is I transferred so I lost credits.
Oh.
And then I had to do I have 2 years left.
Oh. I see.
I just couldn't do it.
Where did you go first?
Occidental College.
And then where did you transfer to?
Woodbury University.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
They're both here.
Oh, that's in LA too?
Yeah. Burbank, Oxy's in Eagle Rock, and Woodbury's in Burbank.
Okay, so you kept it local.
Yeah, I wasn't going far. I was working in nightclubs. I had to stay near the nightclub.
You couldn't get caught up in a long commute.
No, I wasn't going to go anywhere. I didn't want to go as it was. It's like at least like local.
That's amazing. Wait, were you doing nightclub stuff when Hollywood was hot for a second there?
Yeah.
Like with Hyde and all that kind of
absolutely.
Stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I worked with all those places. Like all those places you can think of, I worked with. That's in some capacity.
That means that...
Like the Ledoux days? Like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Wait, so that means you're 8 years younger than me.
I probably didn't let you in.
Excuse you. I worked at LA.com. I definitely was let in. So, oh my God, you were like a little baby and I was like a medium baby at that time going to the club.
Well, you were legally allowed to be there.
Legally,
I still wasn't.
So did everyone just like turn the other way
remember,
to
I'm,
that?
I was 6'7" at that point and I've been shaving since I was 12 years old.
Oh.
So... No one thinks that anyone is stupid enough to be under 21 and work in a nightclub. So, joke's on them, right? But I that's how I think I mean, some people knew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're making people money,
they don't care.
They don't care what time it is.
Right.
It's very true.
So were you hanging out with all the douchey celebrities?
Yeah. Thing? Oh, yeah. I had some of those. Yeah, I had some times like that. I did.
Really? You got into all that?
I didn't get it. No. I didn't get into it. I actually, during the entire time that I was working in nightclubs, I never had a single drop of alcohol.
Did you make a conscious decision to do that?
Yeah, for me, it was work. So I was like, I'm not going to, which was like back then, it seemed like very like easy and smart to do. Mm-hmm. But like now I look back, I'm like, wow, that's actually something you'd be proud of.
Yeah, I think so.
That you didn't get sucked into that.
Especially so young.
I was living at home, like with my mother. So I still went home, you know, sometimes 4 a.m, but I went home. I didn't, I wasn't out doing drugs or anything. I, you know, was completely sober during that period. So I think that's why it allowed me to actually help build my hospitality career. It wasn't like years of partying. It was actually years of work.
Do you party now?
Not really. No, I don't, you know, my definition of partying is going to a nice restaurant and drinking really good bourbon and single malt scotch. So
yeah, this guy.
Yeah. I can't go to nightclubs.
You just like, you completely have that out of your system.
It was never really my thing, but I was fascinated by the adrenaline and the business side of it. And like, just, I think a lot of what I learned, cause there's like kind of like a weird stigma with nightclubs, but a lot of what I learned handling volume is from my past in nightlife.
Ah.
Like even the way I operate restaurants now, like if, you know, a lot of people get very intimidated by volume.
Mm-hmm.
And we know if your restaurant's packed with 200 people, which is considered a lot of volume for a restaurant, you know, I'm used to lines of 2,000 people.
Right.
So like it's it really helped me be able to think quickly and deal with a lot of just if people are angry or too drunk or mad or like being able to fix situations quickly and nip them in the bud versus, you know, it teaches you a lot about that. So I do think it's good to have fundamentals in nightlife. But yeah, it was completely clean. But yes, I did encounter some of those douches that you were mentioning. But I didn't get sucked in to the lifestyle.
That was good.
That's, I didn't get sucked in.
I'm sure that's, you know,
it's hard not to get sucked in when you're like 17.
Like, I can't even imagine. You must have, I mean, honestly, like, you might not want to admit to it now, but you must have thought all those guys were so cool.
Oh,
like, all those, that 70 Shows guys and all that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, all those guys were very prominent in that in 2007, 2008, before the recession hit, it was all that whole red carpet, Brent Boldhouse, Dolce Group days, like, were very, I mean, that's what they owned nightlife.
Yeah.
You know, you had, you know, 3 nightclubs that were basically impossible to get into, pretty much. But
which one were they? Which one?
I think it was Ledoux, Hyde, and I mean, Aria was like that for a little bit too, but when people think of like the Hills days, you think Ledoux, right? Like that was the one that was really, you know, there was a time where the Avalon was actually hard to get into. Like, I tell people and they're like, there's no way. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Like it was like we had to filter. Like it wasn't. But yeah, I think those were, you know, those were Spider Club, which turned into Bardot.
Yes.
Because I was working that too, because it was part of the Avalon.
Yes.
There's a time that was really hard to get into as well.
Oh my gosh. This is totally bringing
this is like memory. I know.
Yeah. I know. It wasn't necessarily my scene either, but I was covering it for LA.com.
Right.
And so
That was when like 944 magazine stuff was around.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, with the pre-recession, like, let's go to clubs.
Right.
Let's comp everything. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, there was a side of it that I do miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I often talk about it with you know, friends of mine who didn't live it or friends of mine who did. But, you know, I think there's no nightclub today that's really hard to get into. And I'm not saying that I'm like a fan of that, but there was some sort of magical mystique to not knowing what a venue looked like before going in.
Hmm.
And the problem is now is you go on Instagram, you check the geotag and you have photos and people in it. So like you could experience what a venue looks like through Instagram because there's videos and stories and everything. But back then, you know, you had that like, you really had that red velvet rope feeling that when it pulled up for you, like you felt part of something. And now, you know, you're probably on your phone when they pull that velvet rope up.
Right.
Or whatever it is. And then, you know, you're like, oh, this looks like Instagram. Like people don't pay attention. You know, celebrities felt like they could be themselves back then.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're, you know, if they are themselves, they're going to end up on TMZ within 4 seconds.
Right.
So, yeah. So there was, I did like the fact that there was a magical, because we lost old Hollywood in Los Angeles decades ago. Right.
Uh-huh.
But I like that there was almost like this new unattainable kind of magic that was what people think Los Angeles is, because people from around the world think that LA is like this magical land.
Very true.
Of fame and celebrity and dreams, right? But which it isn't really. Once you live here, you really see that that's not what it is. But that I like that there was a little bit of that dream alive back then. You know what I mean? And I think it would be cool if that came back. Even though it wouldn't be places I would go to, it would be cool if that was recreated. I just think you can't anymore.
Right. Because everything's
too open. You have to take all cell phones away. If you're doing that, people are just too much liability with like Ubers. And it's just, you know, you can't now.
Oh, interesting.
And like all of our phones now have insane cameras.
Yeah. Well, at Dave Chappelle shows, you have to give them your phone.
They put
them in those little pouches that hide. Yeah. So I know a couple like shows it's on Netflix, will do that.
Right.
Not even when he's taping.
Mm-mm. Oh, really?
For any shows.
I think, you know, I mean, I'm what they call a millennial, right? So I get the phone obsession completely. I can't say I don't, but I wouldn't mind doing that.
Right.
You know, for me, it's like, you know, I need to have it for work and because I'm on call all the time. But, you know, if I'm going to be at a show or something like, you know, or somewhere out, it really is liberating to not have it on you.
Yeah. And but to live in the moment.
But now that we're so obsessed with them, people will get angry if you take it away. And it's sad. Right?
Absolutely. We all turn into golems if our friends get taken away.
Yeah. And then like the problem is like as a venue, you know, you have to pay the bills and support your staff, right? You can't do things, unfortunately, where you risk not making money and having people lose their jobs. So you have to think of all these things. So, yeah, unfortunately, I think it wouldn't be able to be done today. But I would love it if someone figured that out.
Yeah.
I would, if anyone wants to do that, I will jump on that. I'll open a bar again.
You're ready for anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So we did a little tangent into the calendar just because I think that that's so crazy.
Right.
That stuff is completely bonkers. The idea that you can change time. The arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, that's the French for you. Like, we think we can just do anything.
That's amazing. So Lobster Thermidor started showing up all over the place in New York City shortly after that. And it cost $1.75 at the Waldorf.
$1.75?
Mm-hmm.
You can't even get like water for that.
I know.
Like tap water.
I know. Isn't that unbelievable?
At the Waldorf?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Wow. It was $1.50 at Delmonico's, I will say.
$1.50?
Mm-hmm. So it was a quarter more expensive at Delmonico's.
What was it costing? I'm thinking like in restaurant, like mindset. Like what was it costing? Like their food cost, if it was under 30%. Like what was that? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like how does that even?
I know. It's really, it's hard to think about now.
Yeah. They had to do a lobster for like under 50 cents.
Even by 1961 at the Waverly in New York. $3.75.
I mean, can you get one now for less than $50?
I would think not, and you would know better than me.
Right. Yeah.
Minimum $40 for Lobster Thermidor now.
Yeah, because we're talking, I mean, it depends how big the lobster is, too. That's the thing.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's very true.
If it's a whole lobster, you're paying more than that. It also depends where it is. Right.
Do you like plain lobster? Like grilled lobster?
Yeah.
So lobster is your jam.
Very few foods I don't like.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Very few.
Yeah. it actually showed up on the Air France in-flight menu, the Concorde from New York to Paris and back again.
On the Concorde?
Yeah, they had it on the Concorde in the 80s.
That's cool.
That just shows like how over the top ostentatious this dish was, right?
Right.
Concorde was very like Gordon Gekko.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful plane though. Beautiful plane. Because the Concorde stopped flying in like, I think it was like 2000 and... It's like late. It was like early 2000s, right? When it stopped flying.
I thought it was a little later than that. But yeah, definitely when I was like, an adult. But you had been on it before?
No. I remember the last trip it took.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing it on TV.
Yeah.
I was like probably like between 10 and 15, I think.
Why did they retire it? Because of safety issues or?
Didn't one crash?
One crash.
Yeah. I think that's why.
Yeah. Maybe there are too few Concorde flights to keep it going after people got scared of it.
Well, because it was mainly, I think you could only go from New York to Paris from the U.S., right? Or could you go?
As far as I know, it was only New York, Paris.
Yeah, that's all, right? Yeah.
As far as I know. Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't my choice of transport, like, at the time. I don't think it would be today either, but I mean, you know, whatever.
So quick, though.
Yeah, I know.
Gets you over there so quickly.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was in 3 hours.
Yeah, it was something absurd. And if you get a lobster thermidor on the way over.
Oh, it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's $1.50 right there. Like,
Absolutely. Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having
today.
Me.
Should people follow you on social or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm at Jeremy Fall on all my social.
All the things.
I keep it simple.
All right. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.